That's music from Stuart Townend, who was there like you. He wrote the song over in England, and it's one of my favorites. Hope you enjoyed that. It is about 11 minutes after the hour on a Winsome Wednesday, and Doug Greenwald from Preserving Bible Times joins us from Columbia, Maryland. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times, and it's a ministry that's been around for, 15 to 20 years, and Doug and the ministry teaches context, which is... Tell us what context is, Doug.
Well, let's put it this way. Let's talk about the gospel writers, since we're functioning with John here later on this morning. The gospel writers always assumed their readers lived when, where, and how they did. Thus, they had no need to explain what everyone knew to be true. They just assumed you knew. Mm-hmm. 2,000 years later, much of what the gospel writers assumed their readers would automatically know and understand is gone, is missing to our Western way of thinking 2,000 years later, as we live in city urban environments with postmodern kinds of thinking. And so context is everything we have to put back in place so that we would understand the passage just like the original hearers did.
So that's really our aim, to try to get the same message they would have received.
We call that the original meaning. Mm-hmm. You know, everything has to start with the quest, and you know, you have to view it as a quest. It's something you intentionally want to dig after and find and pursue and put back together. Our quest is to discern the original meaning as the people who first heard those words, read the scroll, or experienced that teaching or miracle would have understood them. And that puts us into the world of the Near Eastern village, not a 21st century city, with all of the compare and contrast that comes with those two environments. And so what context does is it allows us to unplug the way we Westerners automatically think, much of which is not the way people think in the Bible, and engage the village world of the Bible and think like those people did. And all of a sudden, the three verses that we read in English become 3,000 words from a Near Eastern village perspective. And the depth and the texture and the significance and the insight and the applications just multiply. And that's when our aha moments start to come. But more importantly, the closer we get to the original meaning of a passage, the closer we get to the always intended epicenter of the transformational power of that passage by the Holy Spirit. And that's what we're all about here. So much of our anemia today, as we glance across the world of Western evangelicalism, may well be attributable to the fact that we're not even getting close to the original meaning of many of these passages when we read them through our Western 21st century Hellenistic eyes.
And those aha moments are so hugely gratifying and inspiring and motivating when you get them. And it's like, how come I didn't see this before? This verse I read 1,000 times. I had no idea that was there too. And it's not like you're giving new information. It's stuff that's been there all along, but we're just oblivious. We don't speak the language.
Yeah, and that's sort of ironic. We're so far removed from that first century world that when you try to teach people about it, you'll often get reactions, and this includes the pastoral staffs. Isn't this contextual restoration stuff kind of gimmicky? I mean, do we really need that? I mean, that could really lead us off the trail, right? And the truth of the matter is, we're not doing anything new at all. We're just trying to get back to the way it always was.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when you talk about context, and you and we and our 4 years of podcasts on the website, people should know about that. That's a very valuable library of Doug's teachings now here at Broken Road Radio. But you deal primarily with the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. And then you get in the New Testament, you get into Acts, and then you get into Paul, and that's a different kind of context. The purpose is the same of learning the context, but it's entirely it's a different context, isn't it?
Well, and I would pick out the word entirely that you just used. Yes, mm-hmm. It's different, but it's also entirely different. Mm-hmm. They're Greek, they're not Jewish. Primarily, we're talking about city Christianity, and the Gospels are all about the village life. Mm-hmm. And so all of the analogies, all the metaphors, all the word pictures that are used to describe, say, the Gospels, in the Gospels, are images unknown to the city people in Ephesus, Antioch, Rome, Carthage. And so that's part of Paul's challenge. I got to come up with a whole new portfolio of examples, like slavery, to communicate the essence of the gospel, because these people have no idea what shepherding is all about. They have no idea how a Middle Eastern village operates. They don't even know what a village is.
And Paul was a superb choice, too, because he was raised in a city and educated in an even bigger city, wasn't he?
He was, and he sat under one of the finest esteemed capital R rabbis of his day. He was the Jew's Jew, as he himself put it, and therefore he knew the Jewish world inside and out. But he also was a trained rabbinic mind, which means he had a very, very capable mind. And God gifted him with the ability to also function in the philosophical, conceptual world of the Greeks. And so he was a man for all seasons, if you want to put it that way. He knew the Jewish worldview and the Jewish gospel, if I can use that phrase, extremely well. And he knew how to do the translation, if you will, the adaptation to describe it to the Greco-Roman world. And it's fascinating to watch how he does that.
Well, you've made so many parts of Paul's writings, which have been a mystery to me forever, crystal clear and sensible. And those aha moments are just as plentiful when you get from Romans and beyond there. But it's like a different language. I mean, you have to study it in a different gear than the Gospels.
You do, and you have to immerse yourself in the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand what daily life was like for the average person in the Roman Empire. You have to understand how the cities functioned. And then you begin to understand the issues that Paul had to confront. And mm-hmm. One of the things I do when I have a Paul's Roman World teaching weekend is I'll usually open it up by saying to people, okay, I'm going to give you your choice. It's now post-Pentecost. Would you prefer to be Peter bringing the good news to the Jewish world, or would you prefer to be Paul and bring the good news to the Greco-Roman world? And to use Olympic diving terminology, I will also ask them, will you rank the respective task of Peter and Paul in terms of degree of difficulty? Mm-hmm. And fascinatingly, a lot of people will choose Peter, and the reason is, I've concluded, is they have no idea what Paul was walking into mm-hmm. in the Greco-Roman world. But once they do, they begin to see the enormous task that he had dealing with all these city-related first century Greco-Roman Roman Empire issues mm-hmm. and the genius that was part of him because of the leading and guiding and prompting of the Holy Spirit. Paul never could have pulled off what he did without the Holy Spirit. There's just no question about that. But it makes for a fascinating compare and contrast, you know? I mean, let me just give you one example. Peter basically has to take this message to the Jews. Messiah has come. Now, for 2,000 years, they've been waiting for Messiah. So, I mean, the whole notion of a Messiah isn't new. They all know they've been looking for him. And Peter simply has to say, this is why Yeshua is the truly authentic Messiah. But everything else, they can continue doing if you're Peter. Hey, Jews, you can embrace Yeshua, and you can still go to the temple and do the sacrifice offerings and incense offerings if you want to. You can still go to the ritual purification baths if you want to. You can still practice the feasts and festivals if you want to. You see what I mean here? It isn't that disruptive. Mm-hmm. Paul brings the good news into the Greco-Roman world, and everything has to go for a Greco-Roman. There is only one true God. Your whole pantheon of polytheistic deities has got to go, all the lowercase g's. The major gods, the minor gods, the household gods, the cultic gods. And this is in a world where polytheism is woven into patriotism. So if you reject polytheism, you're rejecting the state. That's sedition. You know, you get the idea here. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that are totally different to the Greco-Roman world from the Jewish world, that Paul's degree of difficulty, to use Olympic diving, is 2.9, and maybe Peter's is 1.9.
Yeah.
And so it's just fascinating to begin to appreciate those distinctions and then see how Paul chooses to communicate through Greco-Roman language, like the brilliant insight the Holy Spirit gave him one day when he says, how do I unite this diverse group of people who are freedmen, slaves, masters, patricians, senators, equestrians, gladiators, brothel girls? Mm-hmm. How do I unite this diverse home fellowships that I have? And he says, you have to see yourself as a slave of Christ. And so he invokes the understanding of Roman slavery, which is totally different from American slavery, Civil War, cotton picking plantations, that kind of thing, which most people had no idea about Roman slavery. Mm-hmm. And once you do, it's a powerful example that he gives. And that's just part of the discovery excitement, I think, when we, people who have some familiarity with the Gospels, with the Old Testament, walk into the Greco-Roman world and we realize, comparatively speaking, we have blank backboards. Our slates are empty in terms of understanding that context. And that's what really makes it exciting, because you can do a lot of backfilling fast for churches and pastors and paraministry types people, as well as the pew, with these weekend conferences that we are hosted by churches.
I want to ask a question, but I don't want to distract us from the wedding at Cana, because I'm looking forward to what you have to say about that. But when is your next Pauline Studies tour to Italy? When does that come up?
That will probably be in about this time next year, okay. 2017.
Next May, then. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you come back from those with just all kinds of incredibly valuable input to Paul's thinking and his methods and his priorities and his challenges. And we'll look forward to that as well. And just people out there listening today should know that you go to Israel and do these teaching tours, and you also go to Italy now, and you've also got one to Turkey, set to Ephesus set up, don't you?
Well, we just had to postpone that one.
Oh, you did?
Political unrest reasons, yeah.
Okay.
First time we've ever had to do something like that, so hopefully a year from now it will settle back down, but that remains to be seen.
Yeah, that's a shame. Well, the wedding at Cana, we kind of started it last week, and we didn't get very far, because it turns out there's a whole lot more there than any of us expected. Now, this was an event that happened early in Jesus' ministry, wasn't it?
Yeah, some even speculate it's the end of the first week of his public ministry. That's a little bit indefinite, but it certainly is early on. And I think we ended last week with this brief observation here, which we might as well pick it back up. But the very first sentence in John 2 is, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. And as we went off the air last week, I made the rapid observation that this couple must really, and the families, really want to do this one right, really want to be appropriate, because in the Jewish worldview, still to this day, getting married on a Tuesday is the best day to get married, because it's the third day of creation, and it's the only day that God said it was good twice. So with that little piece of information, on the third day, a wedding took place in Cana, we're being told, among other things, this is a family who wants to do everything right. They want to do it the best. And then we talked about Cana last week, because as we've talked about before, anytime you engage a passage, question number one has to be, where are we? And we realized that Cana was on the northern route between Capernaum and Nazareth. And it's about a 30-mile route, and you walk 16 to 18 miles a day. And that means you have to overnight between those two towns. And that must be where Jesus has overnighted, because it presumes here that he has a pre-existing social relationship with whoever this family is in Cana. And that's probably the reason why. And why is that significant? because if he's overnighted there in the past, making his journey back and forth between Capernaum and Nazareth, then there's an implicit social contract at work here, no, social reciprocity.
Even the fact that his mother was present seems to suggest that, too, that there were maybe
families
were
close. Yeah, they even may have been close. Part of the clan, the fact that his mother was there. And Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Now, if Jesus is relatively new in his rabbinic position, having just created disciples within the last week, that also would strongly suggest that he has a prior social relationship as well. And so lots of things are taking place here because we are in a village. I've often thought about, but I've never gotten around to it yet. Maybe I ought to write a 5 or 6 page paper or a 75 minute video teaching or something about a Near Eastern village. How does a village operate? Because it's so fundamental to so many encounters, so many passages in Scripture.
Well, again, just let me interrupt here. This is a good example of what you have referred to as context, because as we read that, in Luke, we don't know how big Cana is, but the contemporary hearer of that would have said, aha, Cana, that's that little village between Nazareth and Capernaum. I've been there many times, and I know what it looks like. Hey, I can relate to that. We don't have that same connection.
No, that's true. And so let me just count the number of words here in sentence number one. 4, 8, 11. There are 11 words in the first part of verse 1 of chapter 2 of John, and it probably assumes 2,000 words of understanding, particularly the fact that it's placed in a village. And so John just assumes we know everything about how a village operates. And that's a lot of stuff, actually. But one of the things that's at work here is social reciprocity. So if I've invited you in years past to the wedding feast of my son or daughter, of course you're going to be inviting me to yours. And if I fed you more food than you can possibly eat, and if I provided you with more wine than you could possibly drink, of course you're going to do the same thing for me. Mandatory social reciprocity. And when we get into mandatory hospitality, it is incumbent, it is mandatory, it is imperative that I provide you with more food and more drink than you could possibly consume. Okay? So does that sort of set a stage for the implications of if you run out of wine?
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty bleak situation all of a sudden.
It is a breach of the social contract, and it will bring shame onto the family, onto the steward of this wedding. He'll never get another wedding gig for the rest of his days. And this young couple who's out in the courtyard just having a joyous time celebrating their marriage is on the verge of perpetual shame, and they don't even know it.
And of course, this is an honor-shame culture, which we fail to observe as well.
That's just another leg on the village's understanding stool. I mean, these are honor and shame.
These are big things to them.
Social reciprocity, mandatory hospitality. And eventually we're going to get to ritual purification here in just a moment. But all of this is just implicit. All of this is just assumed. This is the way the village works. When the wine was gone, boy, does John really compact this story. When the wine was gone. Now, the role of wine is important here in understanding what this means, because if we go back to Judges 9:13 or Psalm 104:15 or Isaiah 55:1, we see repeatedly here that the symbolism of wine is joy. So if you run out of wine, your joy is gone. Some have wondered, is this what observant Judaism is in? A joyless religion, okay? So there's lots of joy going out in the courtyard. All this stuff is unfolding in the back room. very few people know that they're about to run out of wine. The vast majority of people don't. They're still having joy. And this joyous wedding is on the joyful wedding is about to become a joyless, shameful wedding. And this young couple will carry this stigma for the rest of their days. Their children will carry this stigma, and their children's children will carry this stigma, because nothing is ever forgotten in the Middle East. And the last thing you want to do is to marry into a family of shame. So we have no idea what's hanging in the balance here for this family for multiple generations.
It would make a funny story for us, wouldn't it?
Well, in this culture. Yeah, funny, sad. I mean, disaster is looming.
But I'm saying in our culture, we would take it much lightly. We might be distressed at the moment, but it would evolve into a story we would slap our knees about and talk about the time we ran out of wine at that wedding. Not so there.
No, at least, you know, if this was at a country club, you could still go to the bar and buy some drinks, I guess, you know, if that's where you had your reception. So we've got this whole issue here of joy. And this impending disaster is about to lead to a joyless state of affairs and condition that will never be forgotten. Okay, now we got to shift gears. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Now, she's giving Jesus a fact. And Jesus says, "Woman, why do you involve me?" And Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." And his mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, there's been all sorts of speculation as to what in the world has been going on here. Some commentators have seen this as a put-down. Others have seen this as Jesus' declaration that he's now independent from her because he's now 30 years of age, he's fully adult, and he's launched his own ministry. Others seem to observe that they think a Jewish idiom is being used here to suggest, you know, what's that to you and me? That's their problem, not our problem. And that he uses woman in a term of respect, which actually he does here. But, you know, putting context aside, all of those interpretations seem to be very inadequate in trying to harmonize what Jesus says with what he does. So I would suggest to you that the previous mentioned theme of social reciprocity is what's at work here. And Mary knows that this social reciprocity, this unwritten contract, is it. They've been good to us, we have to be good to them. And son, I know who you are. You are the Son of God. I know why you've came. I can remember what the angels said. Okay? You've just launched your ministry, obviously, because you now have disciples. Maybe it's a good time to do a miracle, to sort of initiate your ministry. And so I would suggest that all Mary is doing is reminding Jesus of his social obligation. And Jesus knows he has a social obligation here. And so he says, "Woman, why do you involve me?" And you see, what we can't see is the smile on Jesus' face. Mm-hmm. What we can't see is the glint in his eye. And as we've talked about in times past, how do you recognize when Jesus is speaking tongue-in-cheek in the text?
Well, only from the context.
Exactly what he's doing.
Yeah.
I know social reciprocity's work. I know they're running out of wine. And I know you know who I am, and I know what you know that my ministry is all about. So with a smile, I said, "You know, why did you remind me of that?" And of course, Mary says, she probably sees the smile and knows what he's going to do and says, "You know, just do whatever he tells you." Mm-hmm. I think that's this viewing this through the lens of social reciprocity is a much more legitimate, much more contextually sound, and actually much more harmonious way to view what Jesus has just said.
Yeah, and I can buy into that fully. That makes sense now. It brings a certain unity of a purpose and logical flow to the story.
Right. So, Verse 6, nearby stood six stone water jars. Now, it'd be fun to take you and your listeners to the Israel Museum. And I could take you to a certain display where there are five stone jars that are ritual purification jars from the first century. And they are will hold between 15 and 20 gallons of water. They're not pails. They're jars. And the fact that there are five of them would suggest to me this is a pretty big household, which would also suggest they're fairly prominent, which would also suggest they have even more at risk if they're that prominent in the community. And the reason those ritual purification jars are there is whenever a guest arrives and walks into the courtyard, the servants will ladle out some water from one of these five stone jars and will pour it over the hands of the people who've just arrived. And another servant will hold a bowl underneath their hands to collect the water that's been poured over their hands, because the whole point here is we have to ceremonially purify ourselves. This is the world of the rabbis. They're all about ritual purity. The biggest section is called the tractate in the Mishnah, which is the codification of the oral tradition of the Jews. The biggest tractate is all about ritual purification issues. It's a constant reminder that we are called to be pure people. We are called to be righteous before the sight of God. And so you have to ritually purify yourself. And the reason they pour water on top of your hands and the reason they collect it underneath your hands is the rabbis have said the water that removes your impurities has to be moving, has to be in motion. Technically, that is called living water. Water which moves, which gives us a whole new understanding into John 4 when Jesus talks about living water with the woman at the well. Okay? So this is what's going on. So the purpose of this water is to symbolize making you ritually clean. But every time you leave the grounds and come back, you have to be purified again. So this is a procedure you have to do over and over and over again. Okay? So Jesus says, go out to the ritual purification jars and fill them up. Well, now that means you got to find water. And that means you got to haul it. And, you know, this is not going to be done in 5 minutes. Every village is where it is because there's a well. So we at least know there's a well or two in Cana. And so now servants have to get some, what we would call the equivalent of pails, very, very small jars, and start hauling water. And to fill up 15, 20 gallons, say each one was only half full, you know, maybe this has taken 30 minutes. But it's not a several minute task. So finally, all the jars get filled up back to the top, and we pick up the text. Nearby stood six stone gallons, the kind used by Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Let me increase my estimate there from 15 to 20 to 20 to 30. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water, and so they filled them to the brim. So now we know what the total capacity is. Then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. How would you like to be the servant who was given that task? Okay? You don't know. I mean, you've seen the water is now a different color. You don't know it's wine. And now Jesus says, take a ladle of this and bring it to the steward. Well, whatever this liquid is from the eyes of the servant here, what if it tastes bad? I'm going to incur the wrath of the steward. So, you know, there can be a risk associated with following the words of Jesus. That's the point I want to make. Mm-hmm. You don't always know what the outcome is going to be or how you're going to be received if you go to somebody under Jesus' instructions, okay? Mm-hmm. There's something else that's kind of intriguing here. Very few people know that there's a problem, or I should say impending disaster. Only the people who are close to Jesus know it. And the one who really is on top of this is the servant or servants who went and hauled the water and who now seen Jesus ladle out this sample to be taken to the steward. Point being, you want to see miracles happen? Stick close to Jesus.
And you know, there's another aspect about this, and you mention it now and then, but it's easy to lose track of. There's a reason why John included that phrase in the story, because it tips off his contemporary audience as to exactly what you described to us. I mean, so if you read it casually, I think you're responsible, in order to gain full understanding, to ask yourself, why is this here? There must be significance to this particular word, for example, or this phrase. John put it there for a reason.
Yeah, once again, we're left with the observation, every word is in the text for a reason. Mm-hmm. There's not an extra word there. There's not a word that's missing in terms of the original intent of John here to communicate the fullness of what's happening and the dynamics associated with it.
So if something you read seemed inconsequential or trivial or somehow superfluous to the story, think again.
Yeah, like the third day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Is that just thrown in there? No, it's there for a reason.
Mm-hmm. The third day from what, we say? Well, it means Tuesday.
So they did so when the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the wine knew. Okay, want to be close to miracles? Stay close to Jesus and do what he tells you to do. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choicest wine first, when the palates are the most sensitive, and when then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink and their taste buds are dulled. But you have saved the best till now. Okay, let's wrap this up. I won't take you through the arithmetic here, but in terms of a bottle of wine at 750 milliliters that we're familiar with, that we buy in the stores, Jesus has just made 800 bottles of wine, that the kind that we're familiar with. Mm. Okay, at the end of the wedding. Now, I want you to get this. What does wine symbolize?
Joy, happiness.
This is excessive joy. This is, he can do far more abundant. This is abundant living. This is your cup overflows. The whole point of this is the profuseness of joy that Jesus brings.
The reason, John said, 5 or 6, I guess. It's in Luke, it's a different number. It's either 5 or 6. But there's a reason he gives you that quantity. It's pertinent to the story.
It's just huge. Hmm. It's enormous, okay?
Yeah.
Because that's what joy unspeakable is supposed to be about. It's not small, trivial amounts of joy. Hmm. Now, there's something else that's going on here. Jesus has just, this is up at 5,000 feet, Jesus has just obsoleted ritual purification, because wine is also going to be the symbol of his blood. Hmm. And his blood, once shed, is sufficient for all and for all time. And so the notion of always having to ritually clean yourself, the ceremonial part of it is gone. Once is sufficient with Jesus. Mm-hmm. His blood is sufficient mm-hmm. to cleanse, to remove far as from the east to the west. And so the wine is also symbolized of what he's going to do. This is another glimpse, a very early glimpse into Calvary.
And it dawns on me, too, that this is a magnificent illustration of who Jesus was to his newly named disciples at the beginning of their education.
It really is. I mean, they're part of a miracle. The symbolism of it would not be lost on them. I don't think they have no idea about the looming cross yet. They'll connect the dots on that one after Pentecost. But already we see ritual purification becoming obsoleted by Jesus, because what he's going to do on the cross is going to render the need mm-hmm. for ritual purification no more.
This is a true kingdom lesson for those disciples.
Yep.
Yeah. We're talking with Doug Greenwald, again, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. It's a marvelous ministry, and they just happen to have a gorgeous website. You can link to it from ours. There's a Preserving Bible Times graphic over on the right-hand side, or left-hand, left-right. It's the right-hand side of our homepage. It says Preserving Bible Times. If you click on it, it'll take you there right away. You'll discover that that there are a lot of whole things of interest there for you, DVDs and books and essays, and you can even sign up for Doug's monthly Reflections newsletter, which comes to you via email. Doesn't cost you a penny, but it will light up your day, and sometimes it even comes more than once a month. So we want people to be alert to that possibility, too. It's at preservingbibletimes.org. Doug, again, as always, we're grateful to you for your time and your expertise and your knowledge and your wisdom, and the whole package is very special to us.
Thanks, guys. Shalom, shalom.
Have a good week.
Shalom, bye-bye. Shalom, Doug.